get yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today what we want to cover is finish up our discussion last week on the anatomy of inflation. The last couple points I wanted to make, I kind of just summarized rather quickly. I think it's important that we talk a little bit more about a couple of the causes of inflation that are going to deepen here over the summer. And then I want to talk about the jobs report that came out today and what that signifies. And then, as time permits, say something about a topic I'm going to take up next week in much more detail. That topic is the economic war with Russia, in particular the sanctions. A little overview of that. And then next week, stand by, listen. I'm going to go into depth analysis of the sanctions, their effects, both on Russia and on the U.S., the contradictions in the sanctions. What are the sanctions? There's six packages of them. And what do they represent in terms of the American economic empire entering a stage of challenge and, as some say, a beginning of decline. So we'll take that topic up here as an introduction at the end of this show for a deeper discussion next week on that subject. So let's get back to the question of inflation. Last week we talked about the anatomy of inflation, in other words, the structure of inflation, right? Republicans, of course, say, oh, there's too much money. We gave people too much money in the bailout, right? We've heard that one. Or a corollary of that one is that, oh, households are so flush with money and cash here. That's what's driving demand. They say it's a demand-driven inflation. Biden and the Democrats say, oh, it's supply chains, you know, it's China. We had nothing to do about that supply chain, COVID. And it's Putin's inflation. That's a supply side argument. Republicans emphasize the demand side. Democrats emphasizing a supply side. All right. Well, you know, in economics, there's never a single cause of anything. It's always multiple causes interacting with each other. Both Republicans and Democrats, by citing a single cause, are both wrong. Right? In fact, it's not all that useful, I think, to discuss supply versus demand when you're trying to understand inflation. The important thing is what determines the supply changes, what determines the demand changes. In other words, supply and demand are kind of an intermediate level analysis. You got to get down a little deeper and say, well, what's driving supply and demand? So it's not really supply and demand, it's what determines supply and demand more fundamentally. Plus, you got to understand also that economists in the media talk about supply and demand as if the twain never meets, as if they are two separate causes. Well, they determine each other. They cause each other. For example, right, when households are hoarding, right, in other words, they're hoarding the product, they increase the demand for the product. Well, that generates what? A supply problem, right? A supply shortage. Right. And the same thing when you have supply chains, in other words, a problem in supply, a shortage of supply, that leads to businesses stocking up and therefore increasing their demand before there's not enough. So, you know, they It's like two sides of the same coin, supply and demand, oftentimes. You know, some very important statements came out this week. Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary, admits, well, I was wrong about inflation. Yeah, you know, not too long ago even, 2 or 3 months, I think she was saying, oh, it's going to be over. It's short. It's not going to last very long. Well, she had to eat those words here this week. And she said, well, I was wrong. There were unforeseen shocks. Yeah, like a war and sanctions. I mean, come on. You didn't see that happening? The sanctions would cause oil and gas and industrial commodities and agricultural commodity prices to go through the roof? You didn't see that? Well, you're pretty myopic, Janet. Well, there's a lot of people in the administration who made that mistake. Doesn't tell you much about politicians' understanding of economics. I mean, she's supposed to be an economist. Unforeseen shocks. Yeah, she was wrong. You're right, she's wrong. And those who are saying that, inflation's going to dissipate over the summer, they're wrong, too. This is the same argument that Janet made. No, it's not going to dissipate. If anything, it may accelerate. And we'll explain why. And you know, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, came out and said, oh, folks, there's a hurricane coming, an economic hurricane coming. I don't know how strong it is and when it's going to hit full force, but it's coming. Now, who are you going to believe? Biden? This is the best of all economies, right? Are you going to believe Jamie Dimon, the big banker, right? J.P. Morgan, biggest bank, commercial bank in the U.S., right? Saying, ooh, batten down the hatches, folks. We got a hurricane coming. I tend to believe Jamie here rather than Joe, right? And then we have the Fed, the vice chair of the Fed, Lyle Brainard, also come out and put to rest this idea that, has been floating around the business media that, the Fed's going to raise rates twice and then he's going to stop here over the summer, two more 50 basis points hikes, and it's going to stop and assess the situation. Well, Brainard put that to rest, saying, no, there's no plan to stop. If inflation is continuing, we're going to continue raising 50 basis points or more. Joe Biden went and met with the chairman of the Fed, Jerome Powell, here this week, too. You can imagine what they discussed. You know, I'm sure Joe said, hey, can't you guys go a little slower here before the November elections in terms of raising rates? And I'm sure Jerome set him straight, saying, no, we got to look at the economy, not your election. By the way, the Fed is the only game in town for dealing with inflation. The elites have decided that. The Fed's the only game, which means that they're going to use demand destruction, as they say. You know, that's a catchword for meaning, we're going to generate layoffs, and we're going to reduce wage income, and therefore consumption, and we're going to use that destruction of household demand as a way to bring inflation down, when most of the inflation is supply side and price gouging driven, as we'll describe. Well, we did describe last week supply chains, domestic supply, price gouging going on, which is still going on, you know. Latest thing this week, I think last week I mentioned, you got to look at this baby food thing as a really supply shortage issue. Yeah, there was a problem with some tainted baby food back in February, but that was pretty much corrected at the time, well, within a month. But Abbott Labs CEO still won't raise production, still won't open the plants. Well, it's one plant in Michigan, produces 43% of all the baby food in the U.S. I think there's another producer, Rickert or some Rickert group, and between them both, they produce 90%. Talk about monopoly, right? Two of them produce 90% of all the baby food, and they've been complaining you know, the CEOs in that industry been complaining that, gee, we can't increase our profits. You know, there's only two ways to increase your profits. Well, three ways. One way is to cut your cost, all things equal. That'll give you more profits. Another way is to sell more of the stuff. In other words, volume, increase your revenue. But if you can't increase your revenue, you know, well, then you raise your price. And if you're a monopoly, you can do that, you see. There's always the tendency of the monopolies to say, well, you know, selling more is kind of a hard job, you know. You got to improve the quality of your product, you know, and you got to go after the market share of your competitors, and that's not easy. So let's just raise price. And that's what they do. And that's what these CEOs in the baby food industry have been complaining about. Oh, we can't get profits up. Well, why not? Well, because, you know, you got a fixed amount of demand for baby food, because every year about 3.5 million new babies are born in the U.S. And there's not an increase in the number of babies. It's been that, you know, that stable for years here recently. So you're not going to make more money by selling more. What's the, you know, the option? The option is to raise your prices. And that's exactly what they do. Well, how do you raise your price? You create a shortage. They took advantage of this this health issue to create a shortage by not opening the plant when they could have. Well, now he says he's going to open the plant. Abbott Labs CEO, he's going to open the plant. But he says, oh, it's going to take 8 weeks for it to get to the shelves. Well, what the hell is that? You open the plant, right? You got distribution channels. You start producing. You should be able to start getting stuff on the shelves within a week or 10 days. Well, you're going to go slow. That's what. Yeah, well, that's an example of manipulating supply that's going on everywhere, you know, in the industry and in the economy. I even heard there's a number one popcorn maker, right? I forget the name of the company, but it makes most of the popcorn. And that producer of popcorn, now that people are going back to the movie, said, oh, we're going to have some supply problems this summer. Yeah, you're going to pay $20, you know, for your popcorn. Of course, the movie prices are going to go up, too. You just wait. You wait till the 4th of July. You think they're high now, they're going to go up even further. Same thing going on with the airlines. Right? The airlines raised their prices 18% in 1 month. 18% in April. Right? Well, how the hell do they do that? Well, there's some increased demand, no doubt, going on. But Delta, the price leader, says that they're going to cut 100 flights per day. Well, in other words, you reduce the supply, you increase the tickets, prices, right? Yeah, watch those prices go up. Yeah. And you know, that's going on everywhere. That's the price gouging going on. We talked about that last week, right? We also talked about, just to recap here, yeah, there's some demand involved. I would say maybe a fourth of the price increases are demand related. When the economy opened up last spring, right, they finally got some jabs in people's arms, and the economy opened up. By the way, we can talk about that COVID thing, because that's getting worse again. Yeah, a lot of infections going on. Well, you know, they say they're not as bad. Let me digress on this. They say, oh, COVID, you know, Omicron's not as bad. Well, the New York Times just came out with an interesting feature story a couple of days ago that showed that the death rate for people over 65, grandma and grandpa, Omicron's pretty bad. I think it's as bad or maybe even worse than under Delta. So people with, you know, weak immune systems over 65, they're falling like flies. Something like 1,200 a day are dying still. 1,200 a day. You know, that's adding 300,000-400,000 more to our million record here this year. Oh, and don't forget, the money that was supposed to be spent, it was authorized, supposed to be spent for COVID relief this year. I think it was like $10 billion for more vaccines, you know, for the small kids and others who need boosters, for test kits and so forth, and for other PPE. Excuse me. That was stolen. That was taken and given to Ukraine. Yeah, they pulled that money out here and gave it to Ukraine to buy military hardware from the U.S. And now Congress, the Senate, refuses to put the money back. Yeah. Think about that one. They'd rather, they're not giving it to Ukraine. They don't give that money to Ukraine. The U.S. pays, the U.S. war industries, then they ship the stuff to Ukraine. Ukraine doesn't see that money for war goods. Yeah, they get some of it. Yeah, it's supposed to be aid, you know, so Zelensky and the others can skim off the top and make themselves richer. Now, he's done quite well, by the way, since he's was elected in 2019 on a peace ticket here. Yeah, he's done quite well. He's buying nice houses in the West for himself and his family, as I hear. Anyway, this COVID thing, we're in the fourth wave. They don't even know how much there is of it because we don't have good data on all the infections because people are getting infected at home. But hospitalizations and deaths for people over 65 are pretty serious and getting worse. Okay, that was a digression here. The point is that, yeah, we had some demand last summer from opening the economy. Not so much from the COVID relief, you know. As I said last week, maybe only $200 billion got into the third quarter from the COVID relief plan that was passed last March. Well, not last March, March before. $200 billion. And not all that was immediately spent. You know, there's what economists call marginal propensity to consume. Usually, on average, people spend about three-fourths. And if you're rich, you spend even less, maybe a half of what you get, or maybe even less than that. But average people spend about three-fourths. So maybe $150 billion got into the economy on a $5.2 trillion third quarter GDP. You think that really boosted demand prices? I don't think so. I think the economy opening up had more of a demand effect. But then we had, of course, around August, September, this big problem with supply chains. They couldn't find the ships. Yeah, they had mothballed the ships. Then they couldn't find the sailors. You know, and then we had problems in the ports because there weren't enough truckers and people in the warehouses, you know. Well, that boosted prices. That was supply side price factor. And then the price gouging that set in and is continuing. Mm-hmm. But then I want to talk about two things I just mentioned briefly last week with regard to inflation. And that was, we have the sanctions and the war. They're two different things. They're related, but they're different. You know, the sanctions cause commodity prices, oil, gas, industrial metals, and so forth, to go up. Even when they're announced, you see, they don't have to even take effect. Just be announcing them. And because these items are traded on global futures markets, the speculators, the buyers, jack up the prices for these things, these commodities. And that happened. And then you got the problem with shippers who just don't want to bring their ships into the Black Sea, or sailors who don't want to work on those ships going into the Black Sea. You know, I mean, who wants to get on a vessel heading for Odessa? I don't know. Not too many folks, I think. Not too many sailors want to do that. Okay. And then you got insurers who just won't insure the ships. So the owners of the ship said, well, we're not sending anything in there. I mean, that whole bay there around Odessa is full of Ukrainian mines, you know. We're not going to go there. and risk the loss of our ship. Because, you know, a lot of these insurance contracts make exceptions for matters of war and matters, you know, what do they call it? There's a name for it. For unknown disasters and wars, they, you know, the insurers don't insure in those cases, and they won't insure those ships, you know. So there's a difference between the sanctions and the war itself, although they do complement each other, but both result in supply problems. You know, it was interesting for a while there. You had a new narrative building within NATO, particularly the Baltics and Poland, and you know, some of the more rabid neocons in the U.S. saying that we should send U.S. ships to escort the grain ships from Ukraine, right out of Odessa. We need to send U.S. ships. You know, and if they come in conflict with Russia, then okay. You know, we'll duke it out, right? Well, you know, the problem is Turkey won't let them through the Bosphorus, for one thing. Another thing is, boy, that's a good way to, you know, to provoke a direct conflict with Russia. Well, that narrative, you know, was designed to blame Russia for not allowing the ships and the grain ships, and therefore Russia is the cause of the starvation, you know, that's beginning to set in here in emerging markets, particularly in North Africa and Asia. Well, you know, Russia came out and said, well, we don't care, you know, let the grain ships go, you know. But they're going to have to talk to the Ukrainians as to where their mines are. Well, let's stop that narrative. You don't hear that one anymore. By the way, the narrative that, the Russian soldiers are raping all the Ukrainian women wherever they go, that was put to bed too. I think the UN or some international body demanded evidence from the European propagandists who were pushing that one, and they couldn't come up with it, so, you know, they threw that one out the window. It's pretty hard to understand what's going on in Ukraine militarily, you know, total blackout, total propaganda blackout by the U.S. and Europe, and even sources like Al Jazeera now, you know, won't talk about it. You can get the view from Russia, from RT, and from China's equivalent, and so forth, but, you know, pretty hard to even get to it on the internet. You can't. I think there's a source, I forgot the name of it, but I haven't been able to get to it, see what's going on. So, you know, as far as the military, who's winning in, you know, what yardage and so forth, I think there's a source called southernsomething.org, southernfront.org or something like that, that produces some data. Anyway, that's a digression. Let's get back to, you know, the new causes of inflation that I mentioned very briefly last week that I want to say something more about, you know, beyond just the sanctions, which, by the way, will get worse. Yeah, there's some moves with regard to the sanctions here. You know, we got another package of sanctions that came out, announced, and significantly, of course, you don't hear anything about the sanctions on natural gas because Europe has no alternative. It's going to take 3 to 5 years for alternative natural gas production to increase. The shipping and the ports and, you know, whether it's from Qatar or wherever, or Algeria, there's just not enough capacity. So they don't even talk about imposing sanctions on that. But, you know, big discussion here and some sanctions implemented on the oil coming from Russia to Europe, to EU. And, of course, you know, Hungary and to some extent, not so publicly, Italy opposed that. You know, they're totally dependent almost on Russian oil, high-grade Russian oil, coming via pipeline. So what the U.S. and EU has done is said, okay, you know, we're gonna embargo Russian oil on ships. In other words, no more tanker ships carrying Russian oil coming to Amsterdam, right? Yeah. Well, but we're going to take 6 months to implement it slowly. Mm-hmm. And we're going to exempt Hungary, and I don't know if there's anybody else, but from that. So they're really exempting, by December, 90% of ship-based tanker oil from Russia, which means the EU's got to run around and find alternative sources, because I think like 30% of their oil comes from Russia, and it's pretty high-grade oil that their European refineries can handle. Now they got to go around the world and find equivalent high-grade oil in order to be able to refine it. And it's not been easy. And, you know, Biden got them to go along with that. So Biden is on the hook to find alternative high-grade oil for him as well. And he's running around the world trying to find it, right? Oh, he raised some possibility there, but well, maybe Iran. Well, the neocons shut that down real quick. And then there was a trial balloon. Well, maybe Venezuela will sell us some oil. Well, that was shut down by the Cuban exiles in Florida and elsewhere, right? That was shut down. So now he's running Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia said, okay, you know, very cleverly, we'll increase our output here a little bit. And I've heard different amounts in this agreement just signed here, 250,000 barrels a day or 650,000 barrels a day, whatever. I'm not sure which one it is. Some say it's really 250 net new because they already indicated about 400 that they Saudi Arabia, right? And the U.S. wanted to get the Saudis to throw Russia out of OPEC. Right. Well, the Saudis won't throw Russia out of OPEC, they said. And, you know, they give this token increase of, well, let's say it's 650,000 barrels. Well, you know, they're sanctioned and boycotted and embargoed about 3 million barrels a day out of Russia to Europe. So they're going to get 600,000 from the Saudis. That's not enough. And they can't get it from other OPEC countries like Nigeria and so forth because they're all maxed out in terms of their production. They're not going to get any more out of them. So, you know, I don't think these oil sanctions are going to go too far. Yeah, a little farther than the, you know, on print only, the natural gas sanctions. But then we have these other sanctions, you know, the industrial commodities that are all very important, and even grains. Almost most of the world's natural fertilizer comes out of Russia. Wheat, sunflower oil, and so forth, right? Nickel, palladium, aluminum, right? All these are rising in prices, even before the sanctions take effect. Again, it's the speculators, because these are commodities and futures contracts on these that are bought and sold. And then you got the shipper problem. Then you got the insurer's problem, right? So prices are rising already, and they're going to get even worse. They're going to rise even more, right? So we can expect the sanctions and the war, as it intensifies, to drive up commodity prices even more and drive inflation even more over the summer. But then two things I mentioned briefly last week that I'd like to say something more on, clarify. And that is, I mentioned that we got a productivity collapse going on in the U.S. Excuse me. And we have inflationary expectations starting to rise. And I mentioned those as forces that are going to drive inflation further over the summer, but I didn't get a chance to explain them, so let me do that. What do we mean by productivity. Well, productivity to economists is very simple. You increase productivity, right, by producing the same amount of goods with fewer workers. Or with the same amount of workers, you produce more goods. That's an increase of productivity. Productivity lowers unit labor costs for businesses and therefore increases their profits, their profitability, right, their cost. But we got a collapse of productivity going on. We'll see how much it continues. But last month, we had the worst productivity figure since the data was collected in 1947. Well, why is that? Well, businesses just aren't investing in increasing output, but they are hiring workers, you know? So what you're doing is not increasing your output, but hiring more workers, so your productivity per worker going down. And that means your costs are rising for business. And that means you're going to try to find some way to pass that cost increase on to the consumer. And that's especially the case in a lot of small, medium businesses. That's going on right now. Right? Now, the other thing that can raise unit labor cost is an increase in wages. But that's just not happening, you see. So it's all productivity collapse driving unit labor cost. The data came out today showed wages rising, average hourly earnings, they call it, average, right, across all occupations, 160 million, wages rose 5.2%. Now, compare that to your CPI that was out a few weeks ago, right? Rising, 8.5%. So workers may be getting wage increases, but inflation is eating it up and then some. And, you know, that's an average 5.2% across all the occupations. In other words, workers at the very top, you know, the professionals, the tech people, you know, are making six figures plus. They're getting bigger wage increases than the 5.2%. They're driving that average up, which means the rest of the people aren't getting 5.2%, especially if you're at the median. There's some cases of very low-wage workers won't go back to work, and their, you know, restaurants have to pay them a little bit more here. So you got at the two ends of what's called the wage structure, the very high-end professionals getting big increases, some increases at the low end, but the workers, where most of them are at the median, are getting maybe 2 or 3% increase. Wow, we got 8.5% official CPI. Actually, it's at least 10% or more. Yeah. So real wages are declining, real wages. Yeah. And real wage income decline will result in consumption slowing down, maybe even declining before the end of the year. Although, you know, the credit card debt is rising too to offset some of that. So, the point is productivity collapse leads to unit labor cost rises, which leads to businesses passing on those higher costs in their prices to consumers and households. That's going on now. That'll play a bigger role, I think, going forward. And then there's what's called inflationary expectations. Inflationary expectations. Now, this is a demand thing, mostly demand side, not a supply side, right? If households think prices are rising, which of course they do, they go out and they buy something early, usually a big ticket item, you know. But interest rates are rising so fast, we can see it in the housing industry that's come to a halt virtually, and we'll see it soon in autos, rising so fast that inflationary expectations. Well, you can argue the faster it rises, the higher the expectations, and the quicker people want to go and buy before it rises. But hoarding is a reflection of that too, inflationary expectations, hoarding. We saw that with the baby food thing, right? As soon as there was a perceived problem by households, they went out and they cleared the shelves. But also and expectations occur on the investment side, the business side. If prices are rising and accelerating, then that increases business uncertainty. And the more the uncertainty, the more businesses just sort of batten down the hatches and stay pat here and don't invest, right? If you don't invest, you're not increasing the supply, the output, and therefore, you know, you got a supply side problem driving inflation. And businesses may purchase their supplies, intermediate goods early as well, right? So these four factors here, you know, that I just mentioned last week, unit labor costs, pass-through, and inflationary expectations are going to add to the pressure of inflation that's going on right now. And, of course, the war and the sanctions will continue to intensify as a problem. And then we got supply problems, you know, over there in China. China shutting down to try to deal with COVID zero policy, shutting down their industry. Well, that produces a supply shortage, which raises prices here in the U.S. and Europe. So we have these forces that are continue, and I hope Janet Yellen is listening, because she better not say it's going to be over by the end of summer, because it's not. And Jamie Dimon agrees with me. Yeah. Now, what's Biden really done about this? Not much. I mean, look at, you know, pathetic initiatives here to try to deal with this inflation. First of all, you know, he tries to deal with the oil inflation by opening up some and selling some of the U.S. petroleum reserves, strategic reserve, right? Sell who? Sell to the oil companies. How do they sell it? By auction. In other words, the government says, hey, you know, we have so many million barrels here. Come on and buy it. Well, you know, the oil companies got a lot of oil in the ground. They say, well, we'll buy it, but you got to give us a good price. So the government offers a below market price, a little windfall for the oil companies. The oil companies buy the petroleum reserve, and they leave their oil in the ground. So you got no net increase in oil supply. Therefore, prices continue to rise, all things equal. Right. And of course, the U.S. Embargoed its import of oil from Russia, which wasn't very much. And then the U.S. goes and gets Europe to embargo its oil from Russia, which was a lot. Right. And then Joe Biden goes running around the world trying to get more oil for everybody. That's another thing. By the way, you know, this deal with the Saudis here, I mentioned before, you know, maybe 250, 650 barrels a day. Goldman Sachs just came out this morning and said that's nowhere near enough to offset the loss from Russia oil embargo. Not nearly enough. Well, you watch the oil futures speculators drive that price up. So we're already over $7 a gallon here in Northern California, and we can certainly expect that to continue to rise over the next couple of months. What about the baby food shortage here, supply problem? Well, Biden's got an airlift going now. He's importing Nestle baby food from Europe, right? Flights coming over with 17,000 babies fed a day by the airlift, right? Well, wait a minute. There's 3.6 million babies younger than 1 year old born every year. So 17,000 a day, 3.6 million. Okay, well, let's assume that, you know, maybe a million or so are breastfed. So that takes it out. Let's assume that, you know, some of the families is stocked up when they saw it, and they're not hurting right now. But, you know, you still got at least a million a day. A million a day. 17,000 babies fed out of a million who need formula a day. How many flights do you need, you know? I mean, it'll make the 1948 Berlin airlift look like a a vacation travel event. Okay, that's pathetic. You know, why didn't he just seize the damn Abbott factory, right, and force them to produce? Well, he's not going to do that, obviously. Hmm? Oh, and Biden also started talking about, well, we're going to find ways to offset the gas and food price increases and put money in people's pockets here to offset the loss of income from paying those higher prices. But you don't hear about that anymore. Yeah, he said it and kind of got buried somewhere. Oh, but we got Medicare premiums going up. Yeah, in July. Mm-hmm. Well, that's sure going to help put more in people's pockets, right? And then Joe Biden goes and meets with Jerome Powell. And, of course, you know, the solution is to crush domestic demand. That's the solution that they decided on. Let the Fed do it. You know, that's why they created the Fed. One of the reasons why. To take the heat off the politicians so they don't have to do it. You know, have this bureaucracy, the Federal Reserve, do it. Who don't have to stand for elections. Yeah, so the Fed's going to crush demand. It's just a question of how soon, which is a repeat of what it did in 1981-82 in a similar situation when you had double-digit inflation going on because of supply problems with oil. Yeah. Oil prices are, and related utility prices and so forth, are really over half of what the CPI problem is right now. You know, he could do alternatives. You know, what he could do is put a temporary freeze on gasoline and select food and rents, right, for 90 days or even for the rest of the year. He could do that. Oh, academics say, oh, that just bottles up the inflation. And when you lift them, all the inflation comes out after that. Right. Well, there are ways of dealing with that. Look, you know, FDR did it, Truman did it, and even Nixon did it. And at least it gives you some time here, 3 to 6 months, you know, to come up with a more permanent solution and help people in the meantime. Or you could do what other countries are doing, and that's impose an excess profit surtax on oil companies. And then use the money to redistribute it back to commuters and others who need it in some manner. Mm. Well, we even got Gavin Newsom here in California talking about giving people checks to offset the cost of gasoline here. Oh, but we haven't heard about that anymore either. Yeah. Probably won't. Lobbyists get into the act and they just put a damper on stuff like that. You know, Biden finally comes out and he says, well, we got no solution. I'm sorry. We're just going to have to deal with it, you know, for inflation from gas and oil and so forth. You know, with no magic bullet. In other words, tough up, American consumer. Suck it up. You know. And that's what we got. Okay, we also got a jobs report this morning. What did the jobs report say? Oh, 390,000, quote, new jobs. And Biden quickly went on TV to, you know, tout it, right? Well, as I've been saying, these aren't new jobs. These are jobs reopening the economy, right? And I'm not sure how many of these jobs are people leaving jobs and going to new jobs. And a lot of job hopping going on. Excuse me. And job hopping at the high end, professionals and job hopping at the low end. As I said, the statistics show that if you're a professional and if you jump jobs, you can get on average an 18% raise, and a lot of them are doing that. If you look at the report this morning, it was heavily skewed to certain industries like leisure and hospitality, right? Business professional services, transport. So services. But what you don't see is in other sectors, there's a hiring freeze going on, like in tech and some others, and rumors of announcements of layoffs coming in certain industries. Well, that's a sign, you know, that we may have peaked here in the job creation. And there are those I was listening to this guy from Blackhawk this morning on Bloomberg, and he was saying pretty much the same thing, that, we may see a much weaker jobs report in the coming immediate months here, because it's not a picture of the whole economy. It's a picture of, the services that lagged, were way behind in terms of job restoration, we're now picking up. But, in recent months, it's averaged less than 400,000 compared to, in previous months, 560,000. So there's a slowdown going, and it may slow even more. And you got to understand, job creation lags the economy 6 to 9 months. Right. So we had a negative GDP last month, and that means you probably will see a break in sometime in the third quarter in this kind of a job creation number. Right? It's a prelude. Trend is down. The trend is down, and got to look at the other industries. As this guy from, I think it wasn't Goldman, it was some big equity firm, BlackRock. Yeah. And of course, we talked about the problem with productivity going on, and the fact that this report shows a weakening of wages for most workers in the median. You can't look at averages because, those at the top end have been gaining the most, the top 10% of the labor force, 160 million people, maybe 10 to 15 million are six-figure high-paid professionals, right? They've been doing pretty good. Yeah. But, they do 18%, and those in the middle do 2 or 3%, and those at the bottom do maybe 5 or 10%. And what you get is the average hourly earnings of 5.2%. In other words, you got to go behind the aggregate statistic to see what's really going on. And real wages, of course, are even doing worse. Those are what we call nominal wages, what you actually get in your raise, right? Only workers at the top end are keeping up and, dealing well with inflation. Those at the median are really getting hit hard. And that's where most of them are, by the way. And also the problem with this average hourly earnings statistic is that it covers managers and so forth, right? What you got to really look at is a subset of the total labor force, which is called the wages for production and non-supervisory workers. That's what you got to look at for most of the people at the median, because average earnings mean, managers, supervisors, professionals, tech workers, whatever, software engineers, etc. They're doing well. And those at the bottom, restaurants and hotels are desperate to get workers back, and they're offering a little bit more. Excuse me, I'm having a relapse. Okay, so that's the picture with the jobs report. You peel back the onion there, and there's some real worrisome developments going on, I think. Not as great as a spin that Biden's been giving it today. And that's my picture, just to sum up on, the anatomy of inflation as well. Part two, we might call it today. I want to conclude today's show talking a little bit about economic war. Right? I'll go into this in much more detail next week, particularly on sanctions. But, two things that are becoming clearer here as we enter the third decade of the century is that the nature of war is changing because of technology. And also, the American economic empire is under greater challenge, maybe even decline. And it's slashing out and reacting more aggressively. And that's how you got to see what's going on with Ukraine and all these sanctions. The empire, I believe, has decided that they're not going to wait until Russia and China get even stronger. They're going after them now. Right? That's what they're doing. Deal with them now while they're still not as strong as they might be later. And that's why economic war is increasingly important element of war in general in the 21st century. Also, surveillance and cyber war is important. But also, if you look at what's going on in Ukraine, it's pretty clear that technology has rendered the typical World War II equation of massed armor thundering across plains, tanks and stuff, you know, shooting at each other. Those days are gone, I think. Yeah, tanks are shooting ducks. You know, they're too slow. And everybody knows where they are now because of all this satellite technology, right? You can see right down to the insignia on the hats of the officers. You know, and we've got, U.S. has, you know, a whole system of satellites sitting over Ukraine. They know exactly what's going on. And that's helped Ukraine do a lot of ambushing, you know, till the Russians got smart. And picking off a lot of generals and senior officers, you know, because of, you know, the surveillance capabilities. You know, and the U.S. has AWACS aircraft flying, you know, back and forth along the Ukraine border with Poland there, right? So they've they can see pretty far into what's happening. It's the U.S. That gave all the information to the Ukrainians to launch their Neptune, U.S. Neptune missile to sink the flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, the Moskva cruiser. Now, that was done by the U.S., you know. Ukrainians may not even push the button. Who knows? But then all these drones flying all over the place, some of which are, you know, delivering weapons, some of which are just surveillance, and a lot of them increasingly delivering weapons. Kind of long-range artillery now. Well, all that's being run out of Nevada. Yeah, U.S. U.S. Soldiers there are sitting at their screens and so forth. I mean, this has been going on for a while. And a lot of this drone warfare, I mean, you know, the Ukrainians may launch them, but once they launch them, it's the U.S. that uses them to attack Russia. I mean, U.S. is already confronting Russia. I won't doubt that once this thing is over, you're going to find all kind of evidence about U.S. advisors on the ground. You know, maybe not in U.S. uniforms. They may be put on Ukrainian uniforms, but they know how to use this high technical equipment, you know, this new 155 howitzers, right? And now the what's called the HIMARS missiles that'll go 200-300 miles. We're going to enter a stage of standoff here where both sides are just going to be launching these long-range missiles at each other. The U.S. does not want this war to end. Right? I believe the neocons, who got in control of U.S. foreign policy in the late 90s when Clinton couldn't keep his zipper closed, cut deals with them, and they came in, and they've been running the show ever since, I believe. And that's why, you know, 21st century, nothing but war by the U.S. everywhere. regime change everywhere. And it's no different right now. I think they're deeply embedded in the State Department, Pentagon, Defense Department, and they have a lot of influence. And they want to push for even greater conflict here. And the rest of the U.S. military elite and so forth want, let's keep it a proxy war, you know, much to our advantage. You know, we'll fight the last Ukrainian. Yeah. U.S. loves proxy wars. And that's what we got. And, you know, the war has meant that the U.S. has forged a new hegemony in NATO and Europe, you know, with crazy U.K. And the rabid Poles and rabid anti-Russian Poles and Baltics, right? That's the new majority in NATO that pretty much drives the show. And the French and the Germans are kind of, you know, last man out. You know, they were pushing under Trump for more independent influence over NATO, but that's all gone now. The U.S. has reestablished its hegemony and control over NATO, using the Baltics and using, you know, the Eastern Europeans, and of course the little puppy UK always comes around. So the U.S., you know, the Ukraine war has meant a big gain for it geopolitically in that sense. But the wars in the 21st century, I think, are long-range wars, artillery, no more tank and armor, or ships at sea, by the way. You're not going to see that. They're even slower and able to, well, I don't know. Some ships are a little faster, but, you know, going 30, 40 knots doesn't mean anything to targeting a missile from a satellite with a smart weapon like a HIMARS, U.S. smart long-range missiles. That's the war of the future, right? Plow the ground with these missiles and artillery and so forth, and then, you know, send in the infantry. Which means that the missile technology has meant that the aircraft, jets and, you know, fighter bombers are also at great exposure now, you know, with Stinger missiles, Javelins for the tanks and Stingers for the for the aircraft, and HIMARS for long range. Okay, that's the nature of war, I think. And of course, it's more surveillance and cyber war. And of course, it's economic war to disrupt the ability, because wars are economic in the long run, right? The longer the war goes, can your economy handle it? One of the reasons why U.S. has been so successful in its wars of the 20th century is the production capability just simply outproduced its opposition. You know, outproduced the Japanese, outproduced you know, the Nazis, big time. The American way of war is the mass concentration, right? Which is one of the problems with Russia and this invasion. I think Russia probably thought that, you know, a show of force would result in the collapse of the Kyiv Zelensky government, which, of course, would not after 8 years of U.S. propping. That government's not going to collapse. U.S. won't let it. But Russia probably, Putin probably thought that, you know, let's go circle Kyiv and Kharkiv and launch on four different fronts, and, you know, they'll throw in the towel. Which they didn't do. But Russia just didn't have the forces to pull it off. You know, 150,000, maybe 75,000 combat troops on four different fronts? No way. And if you're going to attack a city like Kyiv or Kharkiv, you know, you have to have a margin of 4-1 to take a big city like that. And that would have wiped out the resources Russia had. And that's why I think, you know, Putin fired 100 of his intelligence people there quickly, and then pulled his forces out of Kyiv and concentrated them in the in the Donbass, in the east and the south, which is where he's going to make his gains. Well, he is making his gains there. You know, we have a second Mariupol going on right now in the Donbass there in Luhansk. Ukraine's about to be surrounded. We'll have another surrender within 30 days here. But it's a slugfest, really, with artillery and infantry. And that will continue. That's the nature of war. But the U.S. wants it to continue. You see, the U.S. neocons, I believe, see this as a Brzezinski 2.0 strategy. Brzezinski was the national security advisor for the U.S. back during the Carter days when Russia invaded Afghanistan. And the Brzezinski doctrine was, well, we're going to arm the natives with advanced weapons, Stingers and so forth, and you know, just bleed the Russians until they leave, and that will lead to economic strains and even regime change, which it did. You know, USSR's collapse had a lot to do with that event. So the neocons, U.S. neocons, see you know, an opportunity for doing the same thing once again. Brzezinski 2.0. The U.S. does not want to end that war. They're going to continue that war. They hope it goes on for another decade, you know. Well, we just did this terrorism thing for two decades, right? And then we pulled out of Afghanistan last August, and within a couple of months, there we are in another war in Ukraine. Yeah, so that's the next war. And all that is a reflection of the U.S. economic empire under increased strain, and trying to reassert its hegemony and its power by economic means and direct military means and so forth. And that's the decade we're looking at now. U.S. Imperialism running amok, right, as it tries to restore its hegemony. Whether it succeeds is going to be interesting. But that's the reality now, right? So I think that's pretty close to the hour here, and I'm going to leave it at that. Next week, tune in, because I'll be talking about the sanctions in much more detail. You know, what are they? Which are working? What's the consequences, not only for Russia, but for the EU and for the U.S. and the global economy, emerging markets, right? And look at this whole sanctions thing as the increasing resort, qualitatively changed now, as well as quantitatively, increasing resort by U.S. empire to deal with its challengers and to restore itself here. Very dangerous period, but it'll be pretty interesting now that war is on the agenda again and probably won't end for a while. Okay, that's it. I'm out of here.